Seek wisdom. That's the motto of UWA. Although you might question if that's actually what we're doing here. Is that really what drives the university and its students? Seek money might be a more appropriate motto, and it has the virtue of being able to fit into the same space. You might think it should be seek a career, or win a gold medal, or defeat the enemy. But it's not. The motto of the University of Western Australia is seek wisdom. And although we may not live up to it, it's not a bad motto. Someone has defined wisdom as the power to see and the inclination to choose the best and highest goal, together with the surest means of attaining it. See, wisdom is intensely practical. It's not just airy-fairy, and it's not simply just knowing what is good. It's also knowing how to get it. It's the right word at the right time. It's resisting the temptation to stay up late watching cat videos on YouTube when you know you've got an assignment due tomorrow. And it's not just raw intellect, it's actually having some insight into the world, some nous. The intelligent guy thinks that he can impress girls by showing his intelligence all the time. But the wise man knows that women are not impressed by that. We listened to a bit of the song The Gambler before by Kenny Rogers. He talks about how he met this gambler on a train, and in exchange for his whiskey, the gambler gives him some advice. And his advice is all about playing poker. It's knowing when to hold 'em and when to fold 'em, when to walk away and when to run. That's what wisdom is, knowing when to hold 'em and when to fold 'em. This week we've been looking at the book of Ecclesiastes. It's a book of the Bible from the Old Testament, and it's one of the books that gets classed as wisdom literature, along with Psalms and Proverbs, Song of Songs and Job. And all of them, to different extents, are written to help us grow in wisdom. The author of Ecclesiastes is simply called the teacher, but he's not sort of simply an inspiring kind of teacher that you might have had in primary school. He's more like a philosophy professor. Someone who's always questioning and probing, asking the difficult questions, trying to make us think, trying to help us to become wise. The teacher says, "I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven." And at the end of Ecclesiastes, the editor of the book says, "Not only was the teacher wise, but also he imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true." The teacher of Ecclesiastes gets two thumbs up for wisdom. In chapter 1, the teacher describes himself as the king over Israel in Jerusalem. And that seems to identify him with Solomon, arguably the greatest king of Israel, because after Solomon there was a civil war in Israel and it split in half, and there never was a king over Israel in Jerusalem after that. The Bible records that Solomon, when he came to the throne, God appeared to him in a dream and offered him anything he asked for. And Solomon wisely asked for wisdom. And God replied, "Since this is your heart's desire, and you've not asked for wealth, riches or honour, nor for the death of your enemies, and since you've not asked for a long life, but for wisdom and knowledge to govern my people over whom I've made you king, therefore wisdom and knowledge will be given to you. And I will also give you wealth, riches and honour, such as no king who was before you ever had, and none after you will have." So wisdom is a smart thing to ask for, isn't it? Because if you have wisdom, you'll likely get all the other things that you might like as well. It's a little bit like if the genie appears to you and offers you three wishes. The smart thing to do is to ask for more wishes.
because you get all these other benefits along with it. And there are lots of benefits to wisdom. The teacher recognises those benefits. Here's a few things that he says about wisdom. In chapter 7 he says, "Wisdom, like an inheritance, is a good thing and benefits those who see the sun." So that's those who see the sun is his way of talking about people who are alive, you know, who are out there under the sun as opposed to under the ground where dead people are. "Wisdom is a shelter as money is a shelter. But the advantage of knowledge is this, that wisdom preserves the life of its possessor." Do you see what he's saying? There are lots of benefits to having money, right? If you've got money, you can sort of make a bit of a hedge around yourself. You can prevent some things from going wrong. If you've got sufficient money, then you're not going to starve. If you've got sufficient money, you can hire bodyguards to protect you from people who might want to steal your money. There's lots of advantages to being rich. Yet you can be enormously rich and incredibly foolish. And when you're incredibly foolish, you can just end up killing yourself in your foolishness. And that's of no benefit to you at all. See, Elvis Presley and Michael Jackson were enormously rich, but they're also enormously foolish. And now they're just enormously dead. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, "The quiet words of the wise are more to be heeded than the shouts of a ruler of fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. As dead flies give perfume a bad smell, so a little folly outweighs wisdom and honour. The heart of the wise inclines to the right, but the heart of the fool to the left." Wisdom and foolishness are completely opposed to each other. They're heading in totally different directions. "Even as he walks along the road, the fool lacks sense and shows everyone how stupid he is." When I was a student, I used to live at St George's College. And we used to have a common dining room there where everyone would go for their meals. And there were a group of us who were there at breakfast one day. We were all sort of upper years. I think we were third or fourth years at the time. And one of the freshers came stumbling into the dining hall at breakfast time, and he sort of, as he came in, he sort of boasted, "Oh, I've got such a headache. I drank a whole bottle of scotch last night." And we all kind of looked at each other and we thought, "You fool, you idiot." Like, it's not as if the connection between excessive consumption of alcohol and hangovers is unestablished. Like, anyone with half a brain knows that. But that is what fools are like. The fool lacks sense and shows everyone how stupid he is. But wisdom benefits the wise. There are real benefits to wisdom, yet for all the obvious benefits, there's something not quite right. There's something that niggles at the teacher, something that deeply disturbs him about the whole situation of life. Wise as he is, there's this unresolvable problem that he finds with life. In chapter 1, verse 16, he says, "I thought to myself, look, I've grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who's ruled over Jerusalem before me. I've experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief." He says, I've acquired all this wisdom. I'm wiser than anyone else who's come before me. I'm not boasting. This is just an objective assessment of the situation. I am wise. And yet, what's the point? I've spent all this time and effort trying to acquire wisdom, trying to learn, to become knowledgeable, to become canny about life. And all the effort just turns out to be like a madman chasing the wind, trying to grab hold of something that he can keep and take with him. but he can't. With much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. In the words of Kurt Vonnegut, Plato says the unexamined life is not worth living. But what if the examined life turns out to be a clunker as well? For all the obvious advantages of wisdom, the teacher can't shake the conviction that it's all meaningless. He goes on in chapter 2, verse 13, I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. It's just instinctively better to be wise than to be foolish. The wise man has eyes in his head, while the fool walks in the darkness. But here is the problem. But I came to realise that the same fate overtakes them both. Then I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said in my heart, this too is meaningless. For the wise man, like the fool, will not be long remembered. In days to come, both will be forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man too must die. Do you see what he's saying? What is the point of being wise? Because in the end, all your wisdom comes to nothing. You might be the wisest person in the world, the wisest person under the sun, but pretty soon you'll be under the ground. And what profit will you have from all your wisdom? You might have gained multiple PhDs, written profound books that changed people's lives, had universities named after you. But what does any of it matter? You might have advised prime ministers and presidents, made billions from your wise investments, resolved seemingly intractable conflicts, even prevented wars. But you won't get to take any of those benefits with you when you die. And all the people you might have helped by your wisdom, all the people you may have saved from a premature death by their own foolishness, they're still going to die as well. You'll have spent your whole life seeking wisdom, trying to profit from it, and in the end, you get nothing. So what's the point of being wise? Like seriously, what is the point of being wise? You spend all this effort to gain wisdom and you end up in exactly the same place as the fool. What are you wasting your time for? Why bother seeking wisdom at all? In fact, far from benefiting you, wisdom actually makes your life more miserable. In your wisdom, you might really succeed at life, but if you're truly wise, you'll recognise that none of it matters. And that has a fairly dampening effect on your enjoyment of life. Death, when it's mixed with wisdom, really poops the party. See, at least the fool can kind of thoughtlessly cruise through life. Just like an animal, really. Just moving from one thing to the next, never really thinking about the fact that none of it matters. He never reflects on the fact that his life is utterly pointless. But the wise person doesn't have that luxury. The wise person has that there always in front of them. If you're wise, you know that everything you've ever gained by your wisdom, everything you've ever done, will simply be taken away by death. That makes life miserable. To quote Tiresias in Oedipus Rex, alas, alas, what misery to be wise when wisdom profits nothing. In the face of death, wisdom is meaningless. But ironically, it takes a certain level of wisdom to recognise that. And the teacher does advocate gaining that wisdom. He does think you should be wise enough to understand where your life is heading. It's foolish to pretend that death isn't coming. Yet that is how almost everyone lives. We're a culture that demands constant entertainment, constant distraction. something new all the time so that we don't have to think about the fact that we're all going to die. Something to distract us from reality. Death is banished from polite dinner party conversations. It's taboo. You're not allowed to talk about it because it ruins the party. We'll talk about our upcoming trip to Europe, but we ignore the fact that we're all ultimately destined for death. It's the one thing that we all have in common. It's the one thing that you can be absolutely sure of, even more than taxes. Yet we're determined to ignore it. And the teacher says, that is foolish. That's just living in a fantasy world. No, it might be miserable, but it's better to face reality. He says in chapter 7, a good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death better than the day of birth. It's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. For death is the destiny of every man. The living should take this to heart. See what he's saying? When you're wondering what to do with yourself, don't go to a footy match. Don't just go and be distracted. Go down to the local cemetery. Go to a funeral. Because at least then you'll be dealing with reality. That's where life is headed. And if you're not dealing with that, you're not dealing with reality. You're just living like an animal, not thinking about anything. In chapter 3, verse 10, he says, I've seen the burden God has laid on men. He's made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in the hearts of men. Yet they cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. I know that there is nothing better for men than to be happy and do good while they live. That everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil. This is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it so that people will revere him. Now, what's he saying? He's saying that God has deliberately set up life this way. He's deliberately made it so that there is actually no profit that you can gain from this life. It's like trying to clear a customs checkpoint where they take everything off you. When you try to pass the barrier from life to death, everything gets taken away. We long for meaning and purpose. God set eternity in our hearts, yet nothing we do endures. We can't add anything to what he's done. We can't subtract anything from it. There's nothing we can gain from life, nothing we can take beyond death. Now, why would God do that? Why would he make things that way? Is he just cruel? Is he sadistic? Does he just like mucking around with us? No, says the teacher. No, that's not it. He's actually gracious. He does it so that we will realise there is only one thing that can give life real meaning. Only one thing that it's actually wise to chase after. And that is God himself. Because everything else that you have, everything you might gain in this life, will be taken away from you by death. The only thing that won't be taken away is God. Your relationship with God survives even death. And the teacher says God does it so that people will revere him. He's set up life so that the only thing worth delighting in is God. Everything else gets taken away. So if you rely on anything else for meaning and significance and purpose in life, you'll always be anxious. You'll always be miserable because you know that the things that you actually delight in, that you enjoy, that you feel like make your life meaningful, well, in the end, they don't make your life meaningful because they're just going to get taken from you. But if you are wise enough to see that, wise enough to recognise the futility of all that other stuff, wise enough to see the only thing worth enjoying is God, well, then you can actually relax and enjoy everything else. All the other stuff, instead of being God, just becomes good. You've finally found the one thing that you can take with you. You've discovered the one person who can make your life meaningful. That is real wisdom. But the problem is that if God is the only thing worth having, we are in terrible, terrible trouble. Because all of us by nature have rebelled against God. We're in this diabolical situation where we've rejected the only thing worth having. We think that's wise, we think that's being clever. But we've become fools. We've exchanged the glory of God for stuff that can't last, for money and sex and houses and our reputations. None of it will last. It'll all get taken away. And exchanging God for that is not just foolish, it's wicked. And God is rightly angry about it. We're in this terrible situation where if you've got any wisdom at all, you can see that the only thing worth having is God. The only thing that can give our lives meaning. But in our foolishness, we've actually made God our enemy. Problem is that it's not simply a matter of turning back to him and apologising. See, that is the right thing to do. But it doesn't undo our treatment of God in the past. Nor does it undo the damage we've done to our world or to others in our rebellion against him. I mean, think about it. Even we don't let criminals escape just because they apologise. We don't say to murderers, "Oh, well, you've said sorry, that's okay then." No. Justice demands that they be punished. And that's what God does as well. We've turned our backs on God, so the punishment we deserve is for him to turn his back on us. I mean, that's perfectly fair. The punishment fits the crime. But to have God turn his back on us, that is not the freedom that we think it is. That's hell. That's being cut off from everything that is good, because God is the source of everything that's good. We deserve to be punished with hell, but it's a punishment that we can't possibly bear. It's a punishment that will destroy us. It's a terrible dilemma to be in, terrible situation, terrible hole that we've dug. The only thing worth having is God, but we've rejected him. And he will reject us. If that were the end of the story, this would be a very miserable talk, a very depressing way to end things. But it's not the end of the story, because into our dilemma, God sent his son Jesus, who says that he did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. See, we can't afford to pay the price for our sin. So God sent someone to pay the price for us, someone who had no sin of his own, a sacrificial lamb without spot or blemish. And by his sacrifice on the cross, Jesus actually absorbs God's anger. He takes it on himself, all the anger that we deserve, so that we can go free. He pays the ransom price. He's the hostage negotiator who walks in and exchanges himself for the prisoners, that we can go free. He paid the ransom we could never afford to pay. And it's worth pointing out that no one expected it. There are lots of very intelligent philosophers around at the time and in the centuries before Jesus, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, many wise, very intelligent people who pondered the meaning of life and what it was all about. And some of them had profound insights. But none of them were expecting God to send his son to die on a cross. And to the people who heard about it, it just sounded stupid. It doesn't sound wise. It sounds foolish. And people sometimes seem to think that Christians are unaware that the crucifixion of Jesus as a way to solve our problem sounds foolish. No, we're perfectly aware of that. Sounds incredibly stupid, doesn't it? What a daft thing for God to do. But in his letter to the Corinthians, the Apostle Paul writes, "The message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it's the power of God." For it's written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. The intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand miraculous signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. See, God looks at us and he knows what we're like. We're incredibly arrogant. We have a very high opinion of ourselves and our intellect. So he says, well, blow that. I'm going to do something that you'll never think of. Something that just seems incredibly foolish to you. I'm going to send my son to die on a cross as a payment for your sins. It does sound like a bizarre sort of thing to do. But in doing it, God humbles us. Christianity is not the sort of thing you need to be an intellectual giant to grasp. It's very simple. We've all rebelled against God. We deserve to be punished. God sent Jesus to take the punishment in our place so that we could go free. That's it in a nutshell. Very simple. Even small children can understand it. It sounds like foolishness, but it's actually incredibly wise because it punctures our egos. It humbles us. It makes us realise that it's not all about us. You know, imagine if we could work this all out by our own intellect. Can you imagine how up ourselves we would be then? We would be incredibly arrogant. The cross seems so foolish, but it's incredibly wise. And it solves this horrible dilemma that we got ourselves into. This problem of God being the only thing that is worth having and us turning our backs on him. Because it pays the penalty for our rejection of God so that we can turn back to him and have relationship with the only one who can give our lives meaning. The only one who makes life worthwhile. And one of the interesting things is that when you do that, when you recognise that wisdom and pleasure and work and anything else you can think of is not ultimate, only God is ultimate, well then it sets you free to actually enjoy all the other stuff. It sets you free so that all this stuff that will be taken away by death, you can actually just enjoy it in life now. Doesn't matter that it's not going to last forever, because that's not what you were pinning your hopes on anyway. That's not what life was all about. You know, with work, you can go out and mow the lawn on a Saturday and you don't have to despair that it's all going to grow back in a couple of weeks' time, that you've just wasted your life. No, you haven't. Life was never about it anyway. You go cut the lawn and you can sit down on the veranda and have a beer and enjoy it. It's a hard day's work. Well done. It's the same with wisdom. If you make wisdom ultimate, then you will always be anxious and miserable that it's going to be destroyed by your death. Everything that you gained with your wisdom, all your degrees, all your career, all the money that you earned from your wise investments, all the people that you helped in your wisdom, they'll all be taken away by death. If you rely on wisdom for meaning in life, you'll be miserable. But if you know God and you rely on him for your meaning in life, then wisdom actually has some real benefits. It doesn't matter that the things you earn now are going to be taken away by death. You can just enjoy it for what it is. So in the last chapter of Ecclesiastes, the teacher advises his students. He says to them, listen to me. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come and the years approach when you will say, I find no pleasure in. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark and the clouds return after the rain. when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men stoop, when the grinders cease because they're few and those looking through the windows grow dim, when the doors to the street are closed and the sound of grinding fades, when men rise up at the sound of birds but all their songs grow faint, when men are afraid of heights and of dangers in the streets, when the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags himself along and desire no longer is stirred. Then man goes to his eternal home and mourners go about the street. Remember him before the silver cord is severed or the golden bowl is broken, before the pitcher is shattered at the spring or the wheel broken at the well, and the dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. You see what he's saying? He's saying, you're young now. You can actually enjoy life. So remember your creator now, while you've still got the possibility of enjoying things, before your eyes start to go on you, before the light gets dim, before your legs go all wobbly and you can't walk properly anymore, and you're just stuck in your lounge chair, before all your teeth fall out and the cataracts grow, before you go deaf, before you can't sleep properly anymore, you get a couple of hours in a night and you just turn into that old person who's pottering around the house at night because you can't sleep anymore. Remember your creator before you get all anxious about going outside because there are bad people out there and they might knock me over. Before your sex drive goes on you. Before you just have no interest in that kind of thing anymore. Before your desire goes. Before you die. You've got the opportunity to enjoy life now because you're young. But if you pin your hopes on anything other than God, you will not end up enjoying your life. It'll just become miserable to you because you know that none of it matters. The only way to avoid that would be to stop thinking, but then you're just an animal. You're not really human. But if you pin your hopes on God, if relationship with him is what life is all about, if you take up the offer of forgiveness that Jesus brings, then you can actually enjoy life now while you're young. You've got the opportunity to use your wisdom. You can go and seek wisdom. And there's some real benefit in that, although it's not ultimate, but who cares? That's what the teacher is saying. Don't make anything other than God ultimate. Because if you do, you won't enjoy life. But if you know God, if you trust in him, if you turn back to him, there is real joy and life and meaning and hope. And everything just becomes wonderful. Thank you.